Hello and welcome to Everyday Sublime. This is your host, Josh Summers, and it's a great welcome to you to have you here today. I'm back. There's been a bit of a hiatus in episode publication due to the fact that Terry and I have been very involved in producing a new course on qi cultivation called Purifying Water, the Flow of Qi Cultivation, where we share our favorite assemblage of practices that from a Chinese medical perspective, promote qi flow. It looks at improving lymphatic flow, fluid flow, and ultimately qi flow in the body. And if you're interested in that, there's a link for you in the show notes. But today's episode is really a personal reflection around my evolving engagement with mala-based or garland-based bead practices, using a garland of beads to plant seeds into one's heart for the cultivation of noble and virtuous qualities of the heart. So as I try to say here, this is a talk that exposes the evolving or the evolution of my own view. I had a very degrading and pejorative view towards mala practices for a long time, and I get into that here in the talk. But Terry and I are going to be offering a workshop soon about beads and seeds, and we'll be letting you know about that, but I hope you enjoy today's talk. And just before I give it to you, I want to just say that this podcast is always free, it's ad-free, and it's made available by the generosity of the members of the Riverbird Sangha. That's a online community of folks that are gathered around the practices of yin yoga, qigong, yang yoga, and meditation. And in conversation together, we explore how these practices enliven our lives, deepen our connection to spirit, and help us face the very challenging conditions of the modern day, both at the global level, at the personal level. We're facing head-on the full catastrophe here. And I'm very grateful for all the members of the community that we get to practice with and share our practices with. So thank you to them. And if you're a member, thank you to you. And if you'd like to be a member, if you'd like to join the conversation, if you'd like to join the practices with us, part of your membership gives you half off on all our trainings and workshops. So that's our financial incentive to join. But really, we're trying to create a very inclusive, open, an explorative atmosphere for the full Monty of practice, including the highs, the lows, the plateaus, the phases of growing up, waking up, cleaning up, all of it together, all integrally informed, but based in the body, based in the somatic rootedness in our body, which gives us the terrain from which our hearts can flourish. So without further ado, here's today's talk after a long hiatus. Beads and seeds. So I think for most of you, it's a good morning. Some of you, it's a good day, but welcome to our Monday meditation session. Very good to see you all and be back together with you. I realize I haven't given an update on my niece in a week or two, and just briefly say that my niece, who's living with cancer, is just about 2 weeks out from entering a trial in Seattle. And this is really this trial will be kind of the make or break phase of her, I think, journey with this. It could potentially extend and save her life for quite some time. But the risk is that there's complications with the trial, but then she may not also qualify for the trial. In that if the tumor progresses anymore, that could disqualify her from participation. So there's a sense of the longest 2 weeks in a way. Will she make it out? Will she get there? And that's really the update. She's fairly stable, and her spirits remain buoyant, it seems. We get messages from her over text and talk to her occasionally. and we'll hopefully see her this coming weekend. But for those of you that have been expressing interest and sending questions and prayers about it, I just wanted to update you that 2 weeks we'll know more. So again, welcome to everybody for our meditation session. And if you've been catching recent newsletters, I've been hinting at a theme for today's talk, which last Thursday I drafted the title of the talk as something like My Orientalist Problem with Mala Beads. And I want to speak to this today. And in some ways, the broader theme could be expressed as how my view grew. And that phrase, how my view grew, is directly inspired by a guest who I've had on my podcast a few times, Amiel Handelsmith, who has recently launched his own podcast now called How My Guru View. And he's interviewing, you know, big thinkers and observers and commentators and just talking to them about how their view grew around things. So I thought this would be an interesting opportunity to talk about what my views around beaded practices, i.e. mala practices, were like, and some of the conditions that I think shaped those views, and then some of the things that occurred that made me reevaluate my view and have hopefully helped grow my view. And I should say that one of my intentions for this talk is for the talk to serve as an introduction to a practice of working with beads and specific intentions of practice. I don't expect everyone to have a bracelet or a garland of beads with them today, but just sort of want to introduce some thoughts around this type of practice and how it might be beneficial. So as I feel like I need to start wherever I see the beginning of my practice. Where do I see the beginning of my path? Because the beginning often carries conscious or unconscious views that the practitioner may or may not see. And for me, one way of putting a flag down in the sand of where my practice began was when I was in college and I began studying Iyengar yoga. And so Iyengar yoga is a very niche style of physical hatha yoga, which itself is a very small slice of the great yogic pie of practices. But I, for whatever reason, whatever conditions were there that led me in this way, I began first out of books, you know, going to a bookstore, getting books on Iyengar yoga, taking the book that my dad had on my shelf growing up off the shelf, and following along prescriptions of sequences, formulas of postures, with the hope that if I could just get my body to do the right things the right way, that my gnawing discomfort, my gnawing unsettledness, my gnawing restless anxiety would depart, that I'd be in a sense freed from the things that ailed me. And I can see now, and I've seen this for a while, that when I began Iyengar, I really entered into that style of practice with a bit of the zeal and fervor of a religious convert, in that I wanted to look right. And it pains me to share this, but in looking right in the Iyengar yoga community, that means that men and women are obliged to wear very short shorts with elasticized waists around the end of the thigh, so that it basically looks like the practitioner is wearing a billowy diaper. And there's a few photographs of it still exists of me in various yoga poses with my billowy diaper and white tank top. And it's a reminder of what I thought I needed to do to be in the right way. But one of the things that came with Iyengar yoga with me was just a sense that virtually any other practice was wrong, particularly any other asana practice, any other physical form of yoga was problematic in all sorts of ways. It lacked alignment, it lacked grounding in the Yoga Sutra. It just, there was a way that other systems seemed to lack, and Iyengar yoga held the right, correct codification of answers. But then, and as you know, I after graduating college, I ended up finally arriving to India. I volunteered a year to teach at a small primary school, which on the face of it can sound so noble and virtuous. You know, Josh, he's like, it was a de facto year of service in an unspecific kind of Peace Corps action. You know, I took a year off and for very little money taught children in India. And it sounds very virtuous. But really, if I'm honest with myself at the time, my decision was I just wanted to be in India to get to the Iyengar Institute, to get to my temple. And whatever means would get me there was going to be the means I needed to take. And after that time, I won't go into all the details, but I was also introduced to a path, which I've mentioned in the past, by the Indian yoga teacher, Yogananda, Paramahansa Yogananda, a path called the Self-Realization Fellowship. And as I left India and went back to Taiwan for a year, and while in Taiwan, I was subscribing to the Self-Realization Fellowship lessons that they would print out and distribute to students. And so I was receiving teachings via snail mail in Taiwan. And one of the practices at some point in those meditation lessons was the practice of japa mala, of taking a mantra and repeating it while holding a bead of a mala garland, a bead of a strand of beads together in a circle. And this was my first tactile connection to beaded practices. And at first I was very curious. I had seen other people using mala beads. I'd seen them around India. I'd seen them in various other religious formations, whether it was in Taoist temples in Taiwan or Catholic churches with the rosary. And I'd been peripherally aware of beaded practices, but never really tried them myself. And so when it came up in this tradition that I was exploring, the Self-Realization Fellowship, I dutifully ordered my Rudraksha beads and began practicing with the mantra that they were telling me to practice with. But then there was something in the lessons, the self-realization lessons themselves, that began to feel, for lack of a better word, religious. It was no longer feeling that it was just about spirituality opening me to a deeper, higher, broader dimension of myself, but that there was ways that, you know, moral statements were getting shared around what was right, what was not right, what kind of behaviors, what kinds of things you should eat, what things you should not eat, what kinds of people you should talk to, what kinds of people you should not be engaged with. There was this moralistic tone coming through the lessons that I felt extremely uncomfortable with. I felt like I had been running from organized religion not because I was ever indoctrinated into organized religion. I grew up in a secular humanistic house, but I was raised in a very Catholic culture. My hometown is extremely Catholic. And to my developing eyes, I felt like I was looking at problems of patriarchal religion everywhere I looked. And the news was reporting more and more problems of patriarchal religion, abuses, religious crimes, spiritual crimes. So at some point, I put the mala beads away, and I abandoned the Self-Realization Fellowship. It just felt too religious for me. And this was around the time I finally returned from Asia. And when I got back from Asia, I started my master's in acupuncture in Boston. And that was around that time that a friend invited me to go to the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, for a 9-day retreat, my first retreat, which, as you know, was as many first retreats are, was a pretty mind-opening / mind-blowing experience. But in relationship to my relationship to mala beads, there was an attitude around practice that I very quickly latched onto in the IMS tradition, the broader insight tradition, that I would say tapped into, it became a root of my own view. It became my own view became deeply rooted in the insight attitude. And there's a lot I could say here, but I'll just try to keep it as essential as possible. The essential attitude was that in insight practice, rituals will not get you enlightened. Clinging tenaciously to rigid performances, rigid rituals, prayers of supplication, petitions to higher powers, none of that, absolutely none of that is what would lead you to the ultimate realization of your own awakening. That there was something more radically profound about the Buddha's teachings. He was saying, once one lets go of attachments to rites and rituals, one is then able to look upon bare experience without any projection. And in doing that, in bringing an unbiased, clear-eyed perception to moment-to-moment experience, that in itself was what was required to precipitate a deep realization of freedom and awakening. So in my mind, as I internalized this cultural value of practice, this is where I see my unexamined Orientalism coming to the surface. Now, Orientalism as a word needs a little bit of explaining. It's a term that the social theorist and critic, Palestinian social critic and theorist, Edward Said coined in his book Orientalism to describe a pervasive patronizing attitude of Western gaze, Western perception of peoples from, quote unquote, the Orient. He was referring to anyone from North Africa, the Middle East, into Asia. But as I said in the newsletter, this patronizing attitude can be directed in any direction, and has been directed in any direction against any culture that is perceived as other. And part of the problem of this Orientalist gaze is that it sees the other as the other culture as a fixed, frozen culture, often imbued with qualities of primitiveness. It's a primitive culture that is less developed, less rational, less reasonable, less enlightened. And I want to bring that, put that on the table, because looking back, you know, after a few years of deeply practicing at the Insight Meditation Society, I wanted to do the thing that serious people did, which was go to Asia and practice, go to the root of the real tree. I wanted to go to the tree, the root of the tree of Buddhism in Asia, which for me was in Burma. And it was just a memory came back to me recently where I know I told you about my Vedic religion professor, Lucy Bullitt, at one point, but Lucy and I, she was in Calcutta and she met me in Burma before my retreat began. And together she and I went to the most famous stupa, the most famous temple in all of Burma, called the Shwedagon Pagaya. It's an enormous gold stupa temple. And when we went to pay our respects, went to visit this temple, I saw, you know, just dozens and dozens and dozens of Burmese people holding mala beads, essentially praying on their knees in front of the temple, in front of the stupa. And I was just about to go to practice meditation at the, you could say, the mothership of Insight Meditation, one of the motherships of Insight Meditation that affected and influenced Western practice. And so the juxtaposition here, there's a juxtaposition of contrast. There's the native population practicing with beads and praying to the Buddha, and me coming in, returning to a center that effectively said, all ritual is a form of delusion. Ritual won't wake you up. And I can see now that I had a kind of patronizing pity for the poor folk that were playing with their little trinkets, praying to an imaginary god, when the real practice was right around the corner at this other center that they just didn't know about, but I was fortunate enough to know, that I was fortunate enough to have discovered. Eventually, when I returned back west and came back to Massachusetts, this would have been in 2005 when I finally rooted back. And around then, in 2005, that was what I would say is the beginning of the swell of enthusiasm in Western quasi-spiritual fitness culture. It was the beginning of the swell of real interest in physical yoga. Yoga studios were popping up all over the place. When I came back, I couldn't believe the number of people that I just see on the sidewalk walking around a city with a yoga mat slung over their shoulder. And I feel very fortunate that I found myself working and practicing in a very vibrant community studio in Boston. Some of you are alumni from that studio. Looking back, I can see that I, having just returned from Burma, you know, having had new badges of gravitas and seriousness stitched onto my lapel, new, that I had gone to Asia to go deep. How wonderful that was. How prideful I felt. And in surveying the emerging yoga Western culture, it seemed like it was almost an obligatory act of fashionable sense to put a mala bead on your wrist. That's the way it seemed to me. And here's the irony. In doing that, or in seeing, observing that, the social critic in my own mind, the social anthropologist said, look at all these white people practicing a kind of perverse Orientalism, wearing their beads, seeing their own salvation in some, you could say, some cherry-picked spirituality that they borrowed or appropriated from cultures populated by brown-skinned people. Pretty harsh criticism. It was made worse when I read Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Eat, Pray, Love. If any of you remember that, and many of you may even enjoy it, and I enjoyed parts of it, but I couldn't help feel that when she went to India, that she was describing a story without naming the interpretation that I had, but she was describing a story of privileged white person going to the land of brown people, looking for something that they lacked, and projecting it in a way that the culture that they were borrowing or looking for their salvation in was frozen in a very fixed way. All Indians are just the most loving, wonderful people. All Asians are just this and that. Describing things in very broad, patronizingly cliche ways. So I didn't, during the rise of, you know, capitalist yoga in the West, I felt very uncomfortable about picking up mala beads. I felt like I was participating in a form of reverse Orientalism. And that, those two attitudes, my own Orientalism that I couldn't see, a pitying, patronizing attitude of using beads for prayer as a form of ritual that will never cut it, that will never get anyone anywhere, to, I don't want to be part of a fashion trend. Those two strands were in some ways views that have just been lodged in my mind for years and years and years now. And that's all changed recently. And that begs the question, how does a view change? And I think part of the answer is views change when we can start to see bigger and broader contexts. When our view can include a bigger and broader context, at least it helps me grow my view. So I won't be able to get into all of it now. I want to offer a micro bead practice, even if you don't have beads. That's where I want to close today. But I'll be continuing to give some reflections around the history and significance and maybe value of bead practice as we go forward. But it's almost going back a month now, one of the youngest members of our Sangha suggested a book to Terry. And as Terry read the book, she learned about the woman who wrote the book, but she also learned about the husband of the woman that wrote the book. And that got Terry to looking into some other books that they had written together. And the book that this couple had written together is called The Way of the Rose. The Way of the Rose by Clark Strand and Perdita Finn. And I wonder if I even my saying that sends a chill down any of your spines. Because the rose is a reference to the rosary. And you might be thinking, oh my goodness, is this Josh's April Fool's joke? He's going to start talking about the rosary, or we're going from Buddhism to rosary. What's happening here? Well, what's interesting is that both of the authors are They describe themselves as ex-Buddhists. Clark was a Zen Buddhist priest and monk for over around 15, 17 years. Clark was also the first senior editor of Tricycle Magazine, which is one of the premier Buddhist publication magazines in the West. And the way he came to the Rose is, or the way he came to beaded practice is in itself miraculous and for a tale for another story, another day. But in getting into it, he did his own history. And so the history and context that I'm drawing from is partly from his own investigation, which can be verified and corroborated by any of us. But it's the essential point is that practicing contemplation with beads, here's how I see it now. Practicing and contemplating, praying devotionally with beads may very well be the oldest, most continuous form of spiritual practice humans have ever produced. And in that sense, a beaded practice may be the very oldest form of medicine that has existed continuously through the human species, going back 40,000 years. Which isn't to say bead practice or bead practices are found in the archaeological record 40,000 years ago, but the antecedents to them seem to be. And again, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to keep this brief by necessity. But these bead practices that have formed and appeared cross-culturally for tens of thousands of years, all are rooted in a reverence for what might be called a goddess. They're all rooted in a reverence for Mother Earth and the goddess of many names that Mother Earth assumes. And in this way, the working with beads, working with seeds and beads, as we'll be saying, is a practice that is implicitly rooted in a matriarchal orientation to the world, which is an opposition to a patriarchal structure. It's implicitly ecological, and I would add earth-based and ancestrally oriented, honoring of ancestors. And that short list that I just ticked through, it's feminist, it's goddess-based, it's matriarchal, it's ecological, it's earth-minded, and it's ancestrally oriented. In my own, the view that I can see that I've been holding around Buddhism and yoga practices, that list that I just listed highlights the deficiencies or the glaring absences of an orientation that I had through a more patriarchal form of practice. So I'm going to stop that little side of my talk there. My view is continuing to grow around this, and as I practice with my own mala, new insights about the value of the practice seem to come to me, feel like they come to me. But if I were to, as I am right now, I'm pressed on time, and if I was pressed on time to say, what is the essence of this practice about as I understand it right now? The essence is that the beads in our hand represent a spiritual cord of connection to the earth that gives us life. And when we hold a bead And in holding the bead in our hand, our whole body's energy unites behind articulating our heart's deepest desire for how we want to be in our life. That the mantra, I mean, and there are many mantras we could borrow from, but the mantra that, whatever mantra we use, and I'm going to suggest we explore generating our own or creating, authoring our own mantras, but whatever mantra we use, that it somehow embodies an articulation of our heart's desire. And as I've been listening to Clark speak about the heart's desire for a while, and as a ex-Buddhist, Clark says, you know, you'll never find the heart's desire mentioned in Buddhism. The problem in Buddhism is desire itself. We're trying to eradicate desires to become free. But this path of the mala, or the rose, or the bead, this path is a very different direction. And so I think it will be an antidote for some of the emphasis, or much of the emphasis that I've been sharing already. And I think I'm hoping that it's going to open up a more inclusively egalitarian space here for us to talk about our practice, our heart's desires, our struggles. So it is the 1st of April, and a loose thread of theme that I've been weaving from the beginning of the year is that this year we're going to be looking at virtuous qualities of the heart, identified in Buddhism as a list of qualities known as the paramis. And I've sent out a PDF ebook for all of you to read if you'd like about these. But this month, the quality of heart that is to be examined and explored is the quality of virtue itself. In Buddhism, referred to as sila, ethical moral virtue. And this can sound like the Buddhist version of the Ten Commandments. Do this, don't do that. Do this, don't do that. Don't kill, don't steal. Don't cheat, don't lie. Don't indulge intoxicants. Those are the five training precepts that is often a codification or a listing of what is the practice of virtue look like. Well, don't kill, don't steal, don't cheat, don't lie, and don't indulge intoxicants. And I'll just say that working with the practice of virtue as a list of do's and don'ts has never really worked or connected for me. I've never really connected with it. It's always felt, again, religious, for lack of a better word, like rigid around... another rigid system to make me feel guilty and ashamed for my inability to be quote unquote perfect. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't consider virtue. What does it mean to be virtuous? And so as we go, we're going to sit quietly for a little bit now, soon, but as a short exercise where I'm inviting you to come up with a phrase, a practice phrase for yourself that feels to you like the phrase orients you into alignment with what you hold as your deepest intention. And I realize this could raise a big question. I don't even know what my deepest intention is. I've just been trying to follow the rules for 25 years. What do you mean, my deepest intention? So if you don't know what your deepest intention is, that could be phrase, may I listen to my deepest intention? And so the practice today might be just that. May I listen to or may I listen for my deepest intentions of practice? And if you have something more specific, you can design the phrase however you'd like. It could be around living in kindness, living from compassion. Kindness and compassion cover all the specific facets of virtue mentioned in the precepts of not killing, not stealing, not harming, not cheating, not intoxicating, not lying. But they can, compassion and kindness can frame it more positively. So if you have beads with you, if you happen to have a bracelet or a necklace of beads with you, you could, for the next 15 minutes or 20 minutes, just slowly repeat your phrase. And when you hold a bead, line up your full, all the entire energy of your being to be placed behind the articulation of that intention. There's no rush. You can pause. Your mind will drift. We know what that's like. We just smile, come to the next bead. If you don't have beads, what I want to recommend is you try the Dhyana Mudra, where your thumb tips slightly rest together. So you cup your right hand with your left, allow your thumbs to touch. And the way this could work is when you say your intention, you just, I'm literally making this up today, but you just, when you say your intention, you let your thumbs open and touch again, say your intention, say your mantra, and just sit quietly with the with what the words evoke in your being, silently listening to what's evoked. And when you catch your mind wandering, that's where you begin again, open the thumbs up, close them again, touch, repeat your mantra. So your hands there here, your thumbs touching, function like the movement of your fingers over a bead if you were having beads per se. And those are two suggestions. You can do either one. You could do neither. You could practice in any other way you found you're drawn to. I just wanted to introduce today some of my recent, call it a renaissance of interest in beads. And the seeds that we plant with the beads. So that every time we articulate our intention or articulate our mantra, we're planting a seed deep in our unconscious to sprout in our life in ways that we may not have any real clear sense of when it will sprout. So, how my view grew around beads and seeds. Okay, everyone, thanks so much for your attention today. I hope you enjoyed my reflections. They definitely, as usual, stirred some very interesting and enlivening conversation in the Sangha that meets on Mondays online. If you'd like to learn more about that, check out the link in the show notes. We give you 2 weeks free membership to try us out, and there's a link for you in the show notes on that. You also get a free copy of my ebook, The What, Why, and How of Yin Yoga. And lots of other good stuff, workshops, tutorials, and unlimited access to all our classes that are recorded and stored in our practice membership library. So it's a great resource for teachers. It's a great resource for practitioners. And we're grateful for all the members that support our ability to do this. So we hope you're well. It always feels strange to say that right now, given the chaos in the world, both climatically, nationally, personally. Everybody we know, including ourselves, are really navigating some pretty unbelievable things. And I just want you to know that we send our very best to all of you, and we look forward to practicing with you. So stay safe wherever you are, stay strong, keep practicing, and I'll look forward to seeing you and talking with you soon. Terry and I will be issuing a new Chi Chat shortly too, so stay tuned for that. All my best for now, and take good care. Thank you.